Todd.
Good morning to you, sir.
First of all, I want to say it's an honor having you on the show. I can't believe that I'm having somebody with such great expertise on our show. Let me introduce you to our audience. Emad Qadri worked with the Iraqi Atomic Energy Commission from 1968 until 1998. He was able to leave Iraq in late 1998 with his family. Now in Toronto, in the Toronto area, he was recently interviewed by UNMOVIC, which is the organization that is overseeing the weapons inspections that are going on right now in Iraq. Emad, what was your position exactly within the Iraqi Atomic Energy Commission? Were you an administrator? Were you a scientist? Were you a researcher? What was your exact position and your duties?
Right. First of all, I'd like to correct what you just said. The IEA did contact me through a mutual friend of mine to be interviewed because they know I was with the Atomic Energy of Iraq for 30 years. And I accepted. That was in middle December. And I waited for them for many weeks to make up their mind to come over to Toronto because I wouldn't be able to go to Vienna. My security is not that protected yet. And then before Blix's speech, I got the response that the war thinking has taken over and they're going not to interview me with the IEA.
Oh, so after all, there is no interview, even though, do you think, though, that you have information that they need in order to do thorough and the best possible weapons inspections they need to do?
Yes, I have all the information because I lived with that program for 30 years, and I went through all phases of the Iraqi nuclear energy program, starting with research and then the purchasing of the French research reactors. I was the top leader of the scientific team that was training to on the experiments we're going to buy. Then when Israel belligerently knocked out or bombed the French reactors in Baghdad, the decision was taken to go fully into the atomic nuclear weapon program. I was with that for the whole of the 80s. Even during that time, Iraq was interested in buying a nuclear electric power plant from the Soviet Union. I was also part of that team for 3 years. And then when the war ended, the whole structure of the Iraqi nuclear weapon program ceased to function, and within 3 years it disintegrated. But then the inspectors were in Iraq, and I was part of the sort of encounter with them. So in all these aspects of the Iraqi nuclear program, I had quite a large, I had a modest part in it. I was involved. I wasn't the leader in no way, but I was in the second tier.
Okay.
Management.
And when the one of the things that you mentioned in that brief description was that the bombing by Israel of the nuclear power plant in Iraq, because that's being brought up again because the situation's in North Korea now, just recently in the last couple of days with what's going on within Iran, was that nuclear plant in the process of making any material that could be used in nuclear weaponry? Were you suggesting that that was not a goal of the Iraqi nuclear industry at that time until after that bombing?
There are two questions to this. First of all, in the 70s, I was dabbling personally with the core of the atomic weapon, the spherical enriched uranium. What is the critical mass? When would it explode? And I was doing some reinventing the wheel and doing the calculations for that kind of scenario with an Egyptian eminent scientist who was killed by the Israeli Mossad in 1980. The Mossad are the Israeli intelligence in Paris. They smashed his head with a copper rod. And I was doing that also with Jafar the Al-Jafar. He is head of the whole nuclear weapon program. He's an eminent Iraqi physicist. So we were dabbling with the idea of atomic weapon, but just really very elementary. But when we bought the French reactor in 1976, the contract stipulated that the fuel will be 80% enriched uranium. It'll be rod-shaped, rod cylinders. When we went to train on the experiments using that kind of fuel, the French had, in the meantime, redesigned another kind of fuel, and we were surprised in 1979 that they changed that fuel with an 18% enriched fuel and caramel, like little chocolate pieces of chocolate. which is completely unsuitable for any nuclear weapon utilization. And the experiments would not be able to at all be utilized to produce enough amounts of weapon-grade fissile material. This the French knew very well. I mean, they were not kidding when they redesigned that whole core of the reactor just to give us that kind, which is non-nuclear weapon geared. Now, the Israelis very well knew this, but they're so belligerent, they're so blinded by their arrogance. They came and they bombed that reactor, and within 2-3 months of that bombing, Iraq took the decision to go completely, fully, to get the nuclear bomb. We were going to defend ourselves against belligerence.
You know, one of the things that's going on, as I was just mentioning, there's the situation in North Korea with the possibility of them reinvigorating their nuclear weapons program. It looks like they're moving in that direction. But more appropriate to this conversation is what just happened with Iran. Iran said that they are going to reinvigorate a nuclear reactor, and they said that this is not for creation of nuclear weapons, but this is actually for the creation of nuclear energy. So what you're saying to me from your description of the 1980 nuclear reactor, the reactor that was destroyed by Israel in 1980, is that there definitely is a difference between a nuclear reactor that can be used as a source for nuclear weaponry compared to one that can be used as energy. Is that true?
Exactly. If Israel got its nuclear reactor for the production of plutonium for the bomb from France in 1956. It's called Dimona. And still, Israel refuses any inspection of that reactor. It has produced 200 atomic weapons, at least that we know of, for Israel. That was specifically because the reactor power has to be a certain power, and also the fuel has to be a certain, it has to be rotated at definite intervals. And if that is not being inspected by the IAEA or somebody else, they can very well produce weapons with that. But if the reactor is being inspected and the fuel is being checked, how it is rotated, how long has it been irradiated, you can easily tell that that reactor is either research or electric production, not weapon. But as Israel so belligerently again refuses until now, 40 years after they got that reactor, 50 years now, and it's a very great danger to the Middle East, that reactor. It has aged so much, there is even indications of leakage of it. They even refuse anybody to go and see it until now. Now I ask you, what good has these 200 bombs been doing to Israel in the past 2 years? When the Palestinian critical mass was reached inside the belly of Israel, let them use their bombs now. They so enraged us that they forced us to go into nuclear weapon development because they have the bombs. What were their scientists thinking in the 60s to do with these bombs?
We were speaking with Imad Kaderi. Imad Kaderi worked with the Iraqi Atomic Energy Commission from 1968 until 1998, and he left Iraq in late 1998 with his family, and it really is an honor to have him out on the show this morning, and these kind of voices can't be heard anywhere but here on our program, so all you have to do to donate money to our program this week is 847-491-WNUR, 847-491-9687. Sorry about that, Imad, but it's the only time of the year that we raise money, and so
I can second what you just said, that the voice is not being allowed to be raised.
You know, and
CBS, I think it's American, it's in New York someplace.
Yes.
They sent two people to me a week ago, and they stayed here for 2 years, 2 days in Toronto, trying to authenticate my story. And they did. And we're supposed to have a 1 hour, the 60 minutes show, it's called, I believe.
Yes.
I was supposed to be done last Monday, 5 days ago. Well, they had this, what they call a IA inspector, who was their consultant, CBS consultant.
Right.
He evaluated what I was saying and what I said, and he said, well, since Imad declared his intention to leave Iraq in the early 90s, then the Iraqi government managed to hide from Imad what their nuclear weapon development program was about, and that the CIA has a treasure trove of information which contradicts what Imad is saying. Therefore, CBS dropped the invitation for me to be on 60 Minutes. Well, I got that news back to the IAA. I have some very good friends there. We have mutual respect. They never heard of this guy. His name is Steve Black, supposedly. He said in the past 13 years, not a person with this name was part of the IAEA inspection team. So I tell you, you can tell where he is from anyway. Secondly, CBS itself, the same day that they told me that the CIA has trove of information, an article by one of their correspondents named Mark Phillips on February 20th, 3 days ago. The title of the article is Inspectors Call U.S. Tips Garbage. Garbage is between quotation marks. If the CIA has such important, valuable information like nuclear weapon development, and the U.S. position is so blatantly being attacked now by Blix and al-Baradei at the UN Security Council, what are they keeping the secret treasure for, the information? Why don't they give it to the UN inspectors on the ground? All the information they have already given is, as this guy Mark Phillips says, is garbage. And I believe, I dare them. I dare the CIA, I dare the Israeli intelligence and the British intelligence to provide one shred of evidence that Iraq continued on its nuclear weapon development program after the end of 1991. There would be none, because there is no such work at all going on, because the whole program stopped by the end of the war. And the scientists were dispersed, the management were dispersed, all the buildings, the infrastructure has been bombed. If you take a look at North Korea's infrastructure for the nuclear weapon, it's a whole semi-island with about 10 huge process plants, research plants, production plants, with all the IAEA inspectors running all over Iraq in their jeeps and their SUVs. Where would be hiding these things? In a mirage? In Bush's head someplace?
So how do you feel about the, just because I want to just touch on this one last time before we move on, is the Iranian nuclear reactor. Do you believe that this nuclear reactor, I have no idea if you have access to enough information about it, but do you have any idea if this nuclear reactor could be used in order to make nuclear weapons?
I haven't personally been following, on the request of my authorities, the Iranian nuclear power program since 1974. That's about 30 years ago, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Step by step, I was following all their efforts. When they tried to build the German, with the Germans, Kraftwerk Union, it's a German company that builds these reactors, in the 70s, and in a city called Bushehr, in the south of Iran, I was following all the developments and all the negotiations and the kind of fuel they're getting and the contractual agreements, because Iraq was concerned also that Iran could be doing this, not only the United States is concerned. There are other people who are also looking for their security, by the way. So anyway, by the time when the revolution occurred in 1979 in Iran, that program stopped. And Germany withdrew from it, from completing it. They were very close. They were about 80% done, actually, structure-wise. And that's when the Iranians in the middle 90s, they went to the Soviet Union, and they contracted Atom Energo Export, the company there, to finish the reactor for them. And they're doing that. Now, Iran and Iraq, India, all these states, don't they have a right to develop their own energy resources? The argument that they have oil, why do they need electricity, is really bogus. How long is the oil going to last? How cheap would it be in 5, 10, 20 years? Why do we have to follow what the Americans think us or wish us to do? We have our own indigenous national rights. We can develop any form of energy if we have the scientists and we have the resources for it as we like. We are an independent country. Iran is an independent country. Why the hell should America tell us what to do?
And as you were saying, just because somebody is building a nuclear reactor, that does not mean that they're building nuclear weapons. And
exactly. And this is why al-Baradei is there the past 2 days and even tomorrow, making sure that the inspections of these reactors are in place, which will guarantee no weapon-grade material will be derived from them. Why doesn't Israel let Blix and al-Baradei visit their reactor? I ask anybody to answer me.
You mentioned in your article that was originally produced in the Yellow Times at yellowtimes.org, you mentioned that from 1987 to 1991, there was a ramping up. There was an increase in the amount of work that was being put into the nuclear weapons program in within Iraq, and that until the war happened, the nuclear weapons program was it was accelerating. It was increasing its productivity. It was getting some things done. And but then the Gulf War happened. And you contend that the destruction that happened during the Gulf War did so much damage to all of the nuclear weapons facilities. The infrastructure for nuclear weapon manufacture, for research and development, was so damaged that nothing that it was irreparable. So you say in this article that. And taking into account that the nuclear and scientific engineers and experts who are needed to create nuclear weapons just aren't even doing their work. They're doing no work within Iraq right now. So how could you prove to people, what would be, if you're talking to somebody at a bar and you're in Toronto, you're sitting next to somebody in a bar, you're sitting next to somebody on a bus stop, and you're talking to them and you say, hey, you know, I can prove to you that there are no nuclear weapons within Iraq. What would be the first arguments that you would tell this person, the first few pieces of information that could clinch the idea in that person's mind that there are no nuclear weapons in Iraq?
That's a very good question. But and your account of the historical was very accurate, except for one point, not from 1979, from 1981, a few months after Israel bombed the reactor, that's when the nuclear weapon program started in earnest.
Oh, okay.
Okay, now I'll answer your question. It is quite evident to the inspectors who have been in Iraq for the past 12 years when they got there that all the nuclear scientists and engineers, when they got there in the summer of 1991, 1 month after, 2 months after the end of the war, that all of the scientists, what they were doing, and they were begging us for interviews because we were so busy, we were rebuilding the electric and the electric power stations and the bombed oil refineries and the telephone exchanges. And that took about 1 year, 2 years, completely to finish so things can be shakily working again. Then these same scientists, they were dispersed because they were senior. Some enterprises were created for them so that they can keep their administrative level of being general director, for example. About 18, 20 organizations were set up. The IAEA inspectors went and visited every one of these institutions. They were doing civilian work. Thirdly, there was no more management at all for the nuclear weapon program. They retired, they became recluse, some of them are semi-paralyzed, whatever, they're old. Thirdly, there's no place where even if there is any work, that could be done. All the infrastructures, and this nuclear weapon program does require huge structures, buildings, all the structures were bombed, half of them by the American bombs in the war. And by the way, after 10 years of working on this nuclear program with 6,000 to 7,000 people participating, the American intelligence didn't have an idea what we were doing. They didn't know which buildings we were working in. And now they say we have a program, well, we don't have any. Anyway, there are no buildings because the inspectors came and they finished the rest of the buildings. They demolished the rest of the buildings that we were working on. So literally, we have no roof. If there is such work, there's no roof, physically or metaphorically speaking, over the head of any such nuclear weapon program to be going on. Finally, the inspectors, if they are now in Baghdad, they go and they can see the Iraqi scientists, the elite Iraqi scientists working the program. I invite them to go and be as guests to any of their homes and see the kind of quality of life that they're leaving. Many of them have sold their furniture. One of them, when I was in 1997, his daughter died. And when I went to the funeral of his daughter, he told me he had to sell his wedding ring just to hold this funeral. This is a top Iraqi scientist I'm talking about, 1997. Another scientist who was with us on the design of the bomb, he was calling me by phone. He had some basic programming, solving some mathematical equations, begging me if I know if somebody would even buy it from him, just so that he can feed his children. Now these people are going to make the bombs in Bush's mind. They, Bush and Powell, they make the Iraqis to be superhuman entities to make them easy target for American people to be so that they can attack us. They can have this criminal war waged against us.
Earlier, let me reintroduce you again. We're speaking with Imad Kaderi. He is talking about his article that he wrote in the yellowtimes.org, originally printed there. The title of the article, Former Iraqi Nuclear Scientist Speaks Out. There's a link to that story at our website, thisishell.net. And remember, please be calling in and giving us donations during our phone-a-thon weekend here. You do not hear voices like Imad's perspectives and views like this anywhere else here in Chicago or anywhere else. The collection that we have had on this show. So please be calling in at 847-491-WNUR, 847-491-9687. There are a couple of things that I want to make sure that people understand, but about you and who you are. But first, before we get to that, one of the things that you touched on, is there any way that nuclear weapons research and development facilities or enrichment centers or whatever is needed, any type of nuclear weapons infrastructure could be somehow hidden from the type of surveillance that is going on within Iraq right now?
None whatsoever, and absolutely. And as I said earlier, 50 minutes ago, are there any intelligence agencies of the countries pushing for war, United States, Israel, and United Kingdom to bring out one shred of evidence contrary to what I'm saying?
Is it simply because a nuclear weapons facility is just so massive that you just can't hide something that large?
Well, yes, that's part of it. And there's no more scientists and engineers able to work. Their information has atrophied. It has clotted. They've been out of... No scientific magazine is allowed to be in Iraq for the past 13 years, even allowed to cross the border by the economic sanctions regulations. And there is no management anymore. It is not simple to hide such a grand-scale enterprise at all. And sorry, just to go back, and you mentioned yellowtimes.org. There are four articles I have written, not only the first one. There is one on, there is this other Iraqi defector to the CIA. His name is Khadr Hamza. I wrote an article about him.
The bomb maker.
Yes, and I have lots to say about that guy. And then I wrote an article when Blix, that's what made me come out public, because he missed some very crucial points and he didn't mention them. He was bending to the American pressure, I believed. That was in January, late January. I had an article on that. And lately I had an article on al-Baladi when he spoke to the Security Council 10 days ago. So I have four articles on yellowtimes.org.
Yeah, it's an amazing four-part article. We actually have the link through Redress at our website where it lists all four. It has all
yes,
four of the articles.
Yes, thank you very much for having that on.
And one of the things that you mentioned right at the starting of this interview, so people understand what your perspective is, because I think that people are going to be, you know, anytime that there are anti-war protesters in the streets, there are pundits on American TV saying, then you must be a supporter of Saddam Hussein. You mentioned that your safety is, there are threats to your safety and you weren't able to travel to Geneva, Switzerland. Why are there threats to your safety, and how do you feel about the Saddam Hussein regime?
I don't feel at all positive about the regime of Saddam Hussein. When I left Iraq, let me tell you how I left Iraq, why I left Iraq. When I was in the States in the 60s, close by to you in Michigan, Michigan State University, I took upon it myself I would only marry an Iraqi lady and that my children would only be raised in the warmth and strength of the Iraqi Arabic traditions and cultures, but that their education would be the best I can afford to give them. It is a part and tradition of my family for several generations. When the war ended in 1991, 1 week later, before we embarked on this rehabilitation of the electric power and the oil refineries reconstruction, I went to my boss. His name is Jafar Jaffa. He's the head of the whole program. I submitted my retirement. He was shocked. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I took upon myself to get my kids to their higher education, and it'll be 6-7 years from now when they will reach university age, and I am leaving to get them education. And so he thought I was kidding. He put it aside. But I was serious. I meant it. And I tried to follow all the regulations to leave Iraq legally. I'm an Iraqi. I love my people. But then they said, okay, if you retire and you stay 2 years probation, we'll let you go to give you a passport, let you go. I retired in 1966 and stayed 2 years. I worked for the UN agencies in Iraq, WHO, World Health Organization, and UNDP, United Nations Development Program. Made enough money working for them. But then by 1997, I realized that the Iraq government was playing games with me. They were not going to let me go. They were really breaking down my spirit and my determination to leave. So I clenched my jaws and tightened my belt, and we left Iraq without the knowledge of their government, without their approval, and at the risk of my life and my family's life. And we came to Canada, thankfully. And my kids now are in universities, thankfully. Now, after saying this, I'm no great supporter, and you can tell that. My hair is, because in 1 year, my hair became white from the stress and the psychological pressures I was in and the closeness to death that I was in many times. I'm no supporter at all of this guy. I believe the worst has been done to the Iraqi society under his regime for the past 30 years that has really shredded the Iraqi society. But it's such a deep society, it will rejuvenate, I'm sure. But your question was, whenever somebody wants to put some sense into Bush's head against going to this war, that he is unpatriotic, let them look again. They are not. It's not Bush, by the way. It's not Bush. The Bush, I don't think, has the enough mental dimensions to go into this by himself. There are people like Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz, William Kristol, Kenneth Pollack. These are right-wing conservatives who, after the end of the Cold War in the early 90s, they sat down for their own agenda, their own vision of what America, the empire, should be looking like in the near future. Even this guy, Richard Pearl, one of the key elements there, advised Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, since 1995, in a report published on the internet, he should knock down Iraq first, concentrate Iraq, knock Iraq down. You have other Arab states falling underneath your feet. And now these people, their agenda, their idea of controlling the resources of the world for the benefit of the United States, Iraqi blood for American petrol at the gas pumps, these people are now putting this agenda into action, and they are whispering, and Bush is echoing what they're saying. If many American people should just look at these neoconservatives, what they are saying, they should see a lot of
got to find a better word, huh?
You know, when you have a wound and there's pus in there.
Yeah.
Well, that's a pus I want to talk about.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you mentioned the dismal state of Iraq's nuclear weapons program, and partially due to the bombing of the first war, partially due to the bombing that has been continuing now for 12 years, partially due to the inspectors that are going in. Can any of the same things that you apply to the nuclear weapons program, the fact that there has been bombing of the infrastructure, a total disrepair of the infrastructure, can you apply any of those things also to the chemical and biological weapons programs? I know that you didn't work within those programs, but I would think that they would have encountered many of the same obstacles. But I'm not saying that there are no chemical or biological weapons, but wouldn't they face many of the same obstacles that the nuclear weapons program faced?
You know, have you heard the latest joke?
What's that?
Some Bush goes to the UN and says, we know they have biological and chemical weapons. So the UN asks, well, how do you know? Bush replies, we have the receipts. Shall I continue?
So, and that's a very good one. I'll have to use that in the future, Ahmad. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
So February 3rd, Colin Powell gives this big PowerPoint presentation to the world, telling everybody that we're the greatest country as far as PowerPoint presentations go.
Yes,
and,
yes, I agree on that.
And that it's clear that Iraq has been working towards nuclear weapons over the last decade, a time in which you say that it is simply not true. How did you feel? Do you think that he was purposely giving misinformation to the UN? Or do you think that his scientists are under so much pressure from the government to give them inaccurate information that that is just what he's repeating?
Yes, again, on both accounts, yes. I'll tell you why. Now, first of all, Colin Powell isn't an authority on giving evidences. In 1991, the United States said Iraq is amassing its troops on the Saudi border, and the oil fields that are feeding American gas pumps are a threat in Saudi Arabia. And the Congress and the Bush senior, a senior is a good word because the junior is really a junior, a Bush senior issued the, well, obtained the authority to go to war because of the amassing of the Iraqi soldiers on the Saudi border, right? Well, where's the evidence that they were amassing?
Right.
None was presented until 1995. This journalist in a Florida newspaper, she managed to convince her her editor to dish out $1,500, and she went to Soviet Union and she bought from the space agency there the satellite pictures of that area for these days. And lo and behold, there were no troops at all, as claimed by Colin Powell. And who admitted that after that, after the end of the war? Colin Powell himself. He said, yes, there was no evidence, but it served its purpose. That was 1991. Now, here he is coming again. A month ago, he advanced four evidences, as he called them. To me, there are none evidence on why Iraq should be suspected of continuing a nuclear weapon development program. I can go into each one of them and tell you how untrue, false it is. Let me start with the first one. He ballyhooed that the Iraqi scientists are under threat of death if they ever talked about their secret work, because they signed declarations to that effect.
Right.
Indeed, I signed four or five of these declarations. And believe you me, I read the fine print because I was signing on my life on that thing. And it was exactly the opposite of what Powell is saying, what he said, what he told the world, he told the Security Council. Exactly the opposite. What we signed was that if we did hide the documents and the materials and the evidences and did not hand them over, that's when the death penalty would be applied. Notice how Powell said it. If we talk about them, we'll be killed. It's exactly the opposite. If we hide them, will be killed.
Right.
Now, I would only wish he would have some good Arabic translator. I could, you know, do it for him if he wants and show him the original declaration, what it said. We signed it five times. Now, how good does he have translators there? I don't know. Secondly, that led to the second point. Because he claimed one of the guys is doing centrifugal enrichment. That's a third process for enrichment. We didn't know. They were hiding it. We found it in the house of this scientists, we invaded this house and we hijacked it in a James Bondian manner. Well, the fact is that that line of research ended in 1987-88. It was a cul-de-sac. It wasn't going anyplace. And it was never used as part of the nuclear weapon production program. And the scientists knew this. We knew this. We even mentioned this in our final report to the IAEA in 1997. And the IAEA report, when they came out based on our report, again confirmed the fact that that line of research had nothing to do with the nuclear weapon program, yet the James Bonds of Colin Powell invades the privacy of this guy's home, sees 3,000 papers of his personal. He kept them at home, although he signed the death declaration because he knew they had nothing to do with the nuclear weapon program. He felt safe to keep them at home. Okay? And Colin Powell goes to the Security Council and says, hey, this is the third enrichment process. Well, that's based on Blix's account 2 weeks earlier that they did find these documents at this guy's house. That's one of the reasons I came out publicly, because Blix was even chided by his colleague, Al-Baradei, head of IAEA. The next day, he said, why do you talk about this guy? We know these documents very well. They're only financial statements, his own personal research of his life work, and nothing to do with a program. Why do you bring it out? And I asked Blix this also. Why did he bring it up? The whole argument is false.
And
Blix also didn't point out one thing in that speech of his that made me come out. One of them was he mentioned these reports when he shouldn't have, and Colin Powell clinched on it like a hay of straw. Mm-hmm. The other point is, the day before Blix's speech, my IA contact sent me info that Blix, 3 weeks earlier, had courageously challenged the United States. If you have intelligence information on nuclear weapon development sites, give it to us. Put up or shut up. Because our inspectors are on the ground, they can go and check. Well, nothing was in the news after that. Silence. The fact is, the Americans did give Blix 25 sites. And this is the article I mentioned 2 days ago. By this person who said it was all garbage. The inspectors went to all these sites. One of them was pointed big red marks by the CIA saying, this is it. You find this baby. This is the gun smoking out of their butts, I think. And they found nothing. Now, Blix didn't mention that in his speech to the Secret Council. Why? Why?
And then yesterday on, or 2 days ago on CBS News, they quoted one of the members of the weapons inspection team as saying that the American intelligence is just sending the inspectors on a wild goose chase throughout Iraq.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Anyway, that's what made me come out after Blix's speech. I called the Toronto Star, and I said, okay, I'm going to come out public now. It's too much.
And like I told everybody, like I've been saying, I strongly suggest you can find Ahmad's work, and it's a great website, yellowtimes.org, or you can go to our website, thisishell.net, and you click on Ahmad's name, and it will take you directly to the redress collection of all four of the articles that Ahmad has done. Ahmad Qadri was a nuclear scientist within the Iraqi, let me make sure I have the exact title of the group here, worked with the Iraqi Atomic Energy Commission from 1968 until 1998 when he fled to Canada, and he is unable to travel at this point in time because of his concerns about his safety because of being, an enemy of Saddam Hussein. Yet he has been on our show this morning telling you about all the disinformation that we've been getting from our own presidential administration, our own Bush administration. Ahmad Qadri, I have one last question from you, and it is what we call our question from hell. It's a question that we hate to ask. You might hate to answer. We never know how it's going to go.
Please, I've been called many things. Go ahead.
All right. So this is the last question I have for you. Without war, can we end the oppressive regime of Saddam Hussein?
Good question. I wish it was done yesterday. That's my answer.
Instead of supporting him for all those years?
Thank you very much.
All right. Ahmad, it's been an honor having you on this show, and I hope that you keep writing, because your analysis of what is going on really debunks a lot of the myths and a lot of the propaganda that's going out there. I really appreciate you.
Could you tell that to CBS, please? Send them an email.
I'll see what I can do. All right, take care, Ahmad.
Thanks again.
Live from his home in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, Ahmad Qadri, former Iraqi nuclear scientist. You're not going to hear that perspective anywhere else but here on WNUR. Call up, check out our premiums listing at thisishell.net. Click on premiums and see what you can get by donating to us at